You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael.
A couple weeks ago, the Court of Arbitration for Sport suspended the practice of hyperandrogenism regulation by the International Association of Athletics Federations, which makes rules for international competition in track and field, cross country, and other forms of running and walking. The ruling came in the case of a sprinter named Duti Chand, who had been banned from competing because her testosterone level was higher than that set by the IAAF as the threshold to compete as a woman. Chand was an 18 and under 100 meter national champion in India and won a bronze medal in the 200 meters in the 2013 Asian Athletics Championships. The Court of Arbitration said the IAAF had not proven that naturally occurring enhanced testosterone levels improve athletic performance and gave them up to 2 years to present more evidence. The ruling, besides meaning that Chand can now hope to compete in the Olympics, could spare young women with high testosterone from undergoing surgeries and hormone treatments in order to compete. It could also have reverberations throughout sport and even beyond, the latest salvo in the debates over whether gender is fixed or fluid, binary, or many-sided. Joining me by phone now is Rebecca Jordan-Young, Tau Associate Professor and Chair of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, and the co-author of numerous articles on sex and gender testing of athletes. She's also the author of the 2010 book Brainstorm, The Flaws in the Science of Sex Differences. Beck, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure.
So why don't we start with what is hyperandrogenism, which I think a lot of us probably never heard of.
Right. Well, hyperandrogenism just means that a woman's body makes more testosterone than is typical. It can be caused by many different things, and sometimes women are bothered by it. Sometimes they aren't. It doesn't necessarily cause medical problems. It's important to know that what hyperandrogenism means in sports is different from what it means in the medical context. Doctors don't screen for high testosterone because it doesn't always cause problems, and there isn't a definite number or level that's considered too high. There's so much individual variation. But in sports, there's an assumption that having high testosterone in women is a problem, whether or not there are any health risks for a particular individual. And there's been a lot of health claim made in relation to these policies that really, if you take a look at how they've functioned, it looks a lot like just a justification for being able to target and intervene with women whose own bodies make a lot of testosterone.
I remember when I was a kid, there were always these rumors about East German swimmers not really being women, especially when they beat U.S. women.
Right.
So is that when this fear about women competing who might be too masculine began? How long has sex testing and gender testing, and are those even the same thing? How did that get started in sports?
Okay. So there are many things in your question that I want to kind of unpack and tackle one at a time if I can. So the rumors about East German women, it's perfect because, you know, it was coinciding with the Cold War. And as we've learned since then, in the last more than decade, there have been lots of confirmation about systematic doping programs where women athletes, and not just women, but men as well, were in fact given testosterone and other kinds of steroids to boost their performance. It's really important to separate out doping from the issue of what people's bodies naturally make. When your own body is functioning in a particular way, you're not cheating. Elite athletes all have some kind of differences compared to the rest of us mere mortals. So that's one really important thing to pull out. The other reason doping is very different is that there is evidence that endogenous testosterone, which means the testosterone your own body makes, acts differently than exogenous or doping. So our bodies don't actually necessarily respond in the same way to testosterone that we make versus what we take. Then you also asked, is sex testing different from gender verification, and when did this whole thing start? So let me begin with when did it start. You know, sex testing or gender verification goes back about a century. And from the beginning, only women athletes have been subjected to these tests because of concerns about fraud and fairness, centering on the idea that men could pose as women and, quote, real women wouldn't have a chance. There's actually never been any evidence that men have done that, so that's it's kind of a red herring. But ad hoc sex tests of one sort or another date at least to the 1936 Olympic Games, and then mass certification, meaning that systematic testing of female sex was first done by the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF, in 1946. Then in the next Olympics, 1948, the IOC started their first formal policy. And initially, it was just nude parades. Basically, women athletes had to parade nude in front of physicians. Women were sometimes then subjected to genital exams, evaluation of their secondary sex characteristics, such as breast growth and hair patterns and so on. And those exams were, of course, quite humiliating, and women athletes objected to them. So as soon as it became fairly simple to do chromosome testing, that the Olympics and IAAF thought, well, here's an easy way that's going to be absolutely objective and won't be so intrusive. So in 1967, the IOC and the IAAF started using chromosome testing using cells swabbed from inside a cheek. And that test was based on the assumption that it'd be really easy to sort that test by counting X chromosomes, two X's and you're female. But it turns out that, you know, sex is complicated. It's not as easy as we learn in high school biology. Not all women actually do have two X chromosomes. And on the other hand, some men have two X chromosomes. So, you know, it went through a bunch of different iterations, different things were tried, but every single biological test that has been tried has been challenged and has failed eventually because there is no single thing in the body that can be objectively used to sort all males from all females. It feels counterintuitive, but as I said, its nature isn't quite as neat as we tend to think that it is. So is sex testing different from gender verification? The answer is that they're very tangled up. Sex really means the body, different aspects of somebody's biology, and gender is about social aspects of femininity and masculinity, things like people's expectations about behavior, how somebody moves, dresses, acts, and how others perceive that. So elite women athletes are already in a little bit of a gender bind because sports is considered to be masculine. So excelling as an athlete, and especially being a fierce competitor, already calls a woman's femininity into question. And then because of a lot of deeply entrenched folk beliefs about gender, when somebody's gender is questioned, many people, including experts who ought to know better, often assume that there's something different about her biology. So even now at this point, when we have so-called systematic testing for testosterone, the truth is that initially, it's a question about gender that triggers an investigation of an athlete's sex. It's not true that all women athletes are just systematically screened for their testosterone. What really happens is it's systematic at the point that people have a certain level of win, but usually it's about somebody challenging an athlete's sex. So one athlete or a group of athletes or their coach, the team, whatever, start complaining that somebody doesn't seem like a woman. And if they can get somebody behind that complaint who sports officials see as legitimate enough to question the sex, then a formal investigation gets launched. So even though the policy is technically about the biology and the body, the process of it really drags gender into the mix.
One of the things I read is that I believe all of the women who have had to go through this special testosterone testing and treatment have been from underdeveloped countries, from the global South. And here in the States, it seems like a lot of the focus on inappropriate body types has focused on Black women, women like Serena Williams, the most amazing athlete ever, as we all know, Taylor Townsend, who wasn't going to be allowed to compete by the U.S. Tennis Association, even though she was the top junior girl in the world at the time because they said she was overweight. Brittany Griner, the basketball player who people accused of being a man or suspected of being a man. So what's the relationship between racism and this form of gender policing?
Wow, I'm so glad that you asked that. So to be clear, we don't know that every woman who has been through, you know, the investigations has definitely been from the Global South or has been a woman of color, but it's absolutely no accident that every single case that we know of has been a woman of color from the developing world or from the Global South. So the relationship, on the one hand, it's complicated. There are lots of things to it, but on the other hand, it's really pretty straightforward that there's a very long-standing association of femininity with whiteness. If you go back to the very beginning of when scientists started trying to sort people into groups and came up with the idea of races and landed on particular characteristics to sort people and so on, in their discussions about doing that, race and femininity is tied up so tightly, and same with masculinity, in a way that everything that was the very definition of femininity initially was a description of a Victorian upper-class white woman. So it's about class and about being genteel, for example, literally being light-skinned, and we could go on and on. And the echoes of that just stay with us. Not only is Serena Williams just the most phenomenal athlete, incredible, but if you look at the way that people have this weird, not weird, actually, it's more like a disrespectful and painful. I think weird is too neutral a word. The way in which her athleticism gets pushed aside to focus on her body, if you take a look at Serena Williams, you see this incredibly powerful, beautiful body that's also a very, very curvy body. So if you track through blogs, the idea that somehow that's a masculine body isn't only because of the muscles. I think it has also to do with not being light-skinned.
And also not being demure, I think.
Exactly.
The fact that she makes no secret of the fact that she really, really wants to win.
Right,
that,
she really wants to win.
She's intense in a way that women aren't supposed to be.
You know, these are social structures, so there are, you know, different ways that people both are expected to behave and are perceived as behaving. Martina Navratilova was often described as a man. She was dissed all the time for her masculinity, partly because of her fierceness as a competitor, partly because in the era when she was competing, she was much more muscular than a lot of her colleagues and opponents, and then also because her sexuality was, you know, in the mix, too, and became part of what people were perceiving. This really wonderful bioethicist and, among other things, Carla Holloway, argues that privacy is reserved for socially privileged groups, meaning male, white, heterosexual, gender-conforming, et cetera, and that, you know, if you live outside of these interlocking privileges means that your body is always, to some extent, public. It's more available for scrutiny and probing and coercion in ways that people don't then perceive necessarily as being intrusive. So if you look around, if you just look at the pattern of how male and female athletes are described in the press, you'll notice that women athletes' bodies are so much more the subject of coverage of them as athletes, whereas men's performances, their particular skills, what they do, how they play, the kinds of things that, you know, that they do to train and prepare are much more likely to be the focus. This isn't just about athletes. You could say the same thing about men and women politicians, for example.
I'm speaking with Beck Jordan-Young, professor of women's and gender studies at Barnard College. We're talking about a recent ruling by the International Court of Sport on sex testing of athletes, specifically the regulation of hyperandrogenism or high levels of testosterone.
One of the things I was really shocked to read about, and I think when I first contacted you and Katrina Karkazis, whom you often write with, about an interview. It was after I'd read an article which talked about some of the, quote, treatments mm-hmm. that women, mostly from the underdeveloped world, have been virtually mm-hmm. demanded to go through in right. order to compete. You know, many of them from very poor backgrounds where their whole family or even their whole village was sort of riding on their possibility of success. Talk about what some of those, quote, treatments have been.
Katrina Karkazis and I, who's been, we've been a team working on this for several years now. We learned in 2013 from an article published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism about four young athletes, all of whom were described in the article as being from remote and mountainous regions of developing countries, that these four young athletes had been identified as having high testosterone, high naturally occurring testosterone, through sports tests and by the IAAF, and they were all sent to a medical center in France for evaluation. And the doctors at this center in France determined that in these particular cases, high testosterone was not actually posing any particular health risk to these young women. And yet, because they were working with the IAAF, these doctors proposed to these women that they have gonadectomies, which means surgical sterilization, and even more shocking, they proposed clitoridectomy, clitoral surgery, on these women. They also proposed later vaginal surgery to enlarge their vaginas. So these are women who had some atypical genitalia, but there was, let's be clear, there was no question here that these are women. That's not what was at stake here. They weren't men posing as women. These were not women who had transitioned or something. And the surgeries that were being proposed were, first of all, medically unnecessary, but second, they also had literally nothing to do with sports. Other than the gonadectomy would reduce the testosterone, but clitoridectomy and vaginal surgeries obviously have nothing to do with sports performance. So we were quite shocked. And these surgeries were proposed purely because of an assumption about what normal bodies ought to be. So it's about reducing the kind of variation, the natural variations that happen in people. And these women were subjected to these so-called feminizing surgeries, even though we know that these surgeries have very, very poor outcome. They damage sexual sensation and pleasure. There's been a huge international movement over the last 20 plus years by people who have similar conditions to what these women have, who have been subjected to these surgeries. Typically, the surgeries are done in the U.S. and in Europe. They're typically done very early in life, so they're done without clear knowledge and consent of the person who's having the surgery done. And there's been a huge outcry from the folks who've gone through these surgeries saying, hey, you actually really damaged my life. You created the very problems that you said that you were trying to fix, which was, you know, that I would feel different or be an outsider. It actually is sort of a shocking breach of medical ethics.
So does this ruling of the Court of Arbitration put an end to all of this?
Well, not exactly. Officially, it says that for 2 years, or for up to 2 years, the IAAF has to put this policy aside unless they can come up with evidence that naturally high testosterone creates a sports advantage comparable to the degree of advantage that men typically have over women athletes. So the Court of Arbitration for Sport gave the IAAF time to come up with this evidence of advantage. I think it's very unlikely, honestly, that they're going to be able to come up with the kind of evidence that's been asked for. So I think there's a good chance that the ruling will stick. I also think that although technically the ruling only applies to the IAAF, other sporting bodies are also subject to the jurisdiction of the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So my sense is that it would be difficult for the Olympics to carry forward with the policy they have right now. We'll just have to see what happens. In November, they're going to be meeting and evaluating the Olympic policy, so we'll see where they go. I will be surprised if they're able to hold on to the same policy, given the Court of Arbitration for Sport's decision.
Some journalists and athletes have responded to this case by saying, well, you have to have some standard, and this is as good as any other. There were athletes who testified in the case saying that it would be unfair to allow women with high testosterone to compete. You know, is there, it seems like there's a sense of among some of these folks that if this testosterone threshold is shattered, that that's the beginning of the end for gender segregation in sports. On the other side, some commentators feel like that would be a good thing, that that gender neutral sports is where we should be going. You know, what do you think about both the impact of this ruling, and is gender neutral sports where we should be heading?
One thing that I want to clarify is that although you wouldn't know it from the media coverage, there were also voices in the hearing saying we actually don't need this ruling. So, for example, a former elite runner, Madeline Pape, who has actually raced against Caster Semenya, also offered testimony in the hearing, and it was quite lovely testimony. And she talked about having her mind changed, basically, as she learned more about the complexity of sex and about bodies and testosterone. The more she learned, the more she came to see this rule as unfair. And I think that is a really important thing to underscore, that athletes do not speak with one voice. The athletes like Paula Radcliffe, who has been quoted a lot, doesn't actually speak for all elite women athletes. There are lots of women who say, hey, you know what? There are lots of natural variations that other people I have, other people have, et cetera. I'm not afraid of women with high testosterone. Bring it on. Let's play. Where they got to that place was through a lot of dialogue and education and being helped to understand about the range of things that create a great athlete, the ways in which, you know, early nutrition, having all kinds of advantages of great training, great coaches early. Being in a rich country is an enormous advantage. The United States wins a hugely disproportionate number of gold medals in the Olympics. That's not because we have different biology from the rest of the world. You know, I think it's really important to take a look at what counts as unfair and disproportionate in relation to who do we think should be winning? Why do we think that? I don't actually think that this ruling is the beginning of the end of sex-segregated sports. There's a huge amount of sex-segregated sport going on all around the world right now without most people going through any kind of actual test around it. How does most of that operate? Well, think about it. The way most of it operates is you live in a community, you are known to be male or female in that community, you live your life in that way, and then that's the same way that you compete in sports. There's a whole separate body of rules that deals with athletes who transition from male to female. That a lot of times this discussion gets all tangled up with the idea of transitioning athletes. I think it's really important to acknowledge that that's a separate thing. What I would advocate, and I think, you know, there are ways that you could tweak this rule, but I actually think that being continuously competing and living, being known socially and legally as female is enough to be the rule for entering competitions as a woman, even more than laying out what the rule should be. It's important to back up and say, wait a minute, what was the problem we were trying to solve here? Because in fact, there is no great infiltration of women's sports by men. There's no evidence, in fact, that there's some class of, you know, super Amazon women athletes that are dominating everybody else. The degree of difference in women whose bodies have been investigated and altered. They're not world record holders. These are women who are competing completely on par with other women. This policy is a solution in search of a problem. I don't want to see sex-segregated sports end right now. I think it would be premature. I think that we know there are such different opportunities and expectations around from the very beginning, boys and girls and sports. There, the social barriers to girls' participation and excelling in sport have absolutely not completely fallen. I don't need to go into all of the ways that's true, but there's a lot of very clear research as well as anecdote that shows us that, you know, we're very, very far from being on equal grounds when it comes to having the opportunities and rewards for playing competitive sports.
Rebecca Jordan Young has been my guest. She is Tau Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College and the author of the book Brainstorm, The Flaws in the Science of Sex Differences. We've been talking about the ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sport in the case of sprinter Dutee Chand striking down the IAAF's practice of hyperandrogenism regulation and the use of testosterone levels to determine if someone can compete as a woman. Beck, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kate.